Welcome to ACMN Conversations, a podcast about marketing, media, and entertainment matters. I'm ACMN's Managing Director, Lyndall Pond, and today we are so pleased to be talking to brand and story expert, Tim Wood. Tim's had an impressive career in marketing, working for some of the world's biggest names, such as Nike and McDonald's, to name a few. Now, Tim works with Australia's leading brand and partnership growth consultancy, Fit Brand and Partnerships. He has a passion for stories and the power they bring to brands. He's a great bloke and a really good mate. Welcome, Tim.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you, Lyndall. How are you?
Yeah, good. Good to have you here. It's
Thank you. Great to be here.
Story about a story.
That's exactly right.
I feel like I could start the podcast with a tell us about the power of storytelling and then just sit back and listen, because I know it's such a passion project for you. But for context, let's just rewind the clock. So we can better understand your interest and skills, give us that elevator pitch version of your career to date. I think you coined the phrase shoeologist, so we want to hear a little bit more about that.
Don't you hate it when someone asks for your elevator pitch because it feels like you're on the spot?
You can have three floors.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, I reckon my career could best be summed up as a play in three acts that has a setup, a confrontation, and a resolution. So the first act would be my theatre life. I finished school and I didn't know what I wanted to do, to be honest. And I'd always loved theatre and been around theatre through school life, and fell into it in Melbourne and worked the theatre scene in Melbourne, and then went to Whopper and studied theatre there, and then studied for another 6 years and couldn't crack it, and looked around at my peers, and some were quickly becoming global names and most, like me, were struggling to make ends meet. So that's when the second act started, when I switched into marketing and, as you said, was lucky enough to work for some great brands and some amazing people in that marketing world for another 15 years. And then the third act started, and that's when I kind of got burnt out in the corporate world and switched into my own business about 7 years ago with our good friend, Bruce McCaskill. And so I'm partnered with Bruce in that business now. And the shoeologist, shall I talk about the shoeologist?
Yeah, tell us the shoeologist.
Oh, I love this story. It's so funny. It's bizarre, right? Because my theatre life and particularly in Whopper, I was lucky enough to have some incredible mentors from a storytelling point of view, people who could understand what it's like and teach others what it's like to walk in the shoes of your character, which is essentially the foundation of acting, to not to judge, but to be, to understand what it is to be that person. And so I did that and had some great mentors and learnt through there, and then switched out of the acting world and into the marketing world. And that thought, I didn't even take it with me, and it kind of got beaten out of me in a way where you have to put on the bravado and you think you're shit hot and you're selling a big brand. And then it wasn't until we had a life moment and Em and I decided to quit our jobs in Australia and went to London. And I just couldn't get a job in London. And you know what the UK is like. I tried for 4 months and I tried everything and could not crack it. And it was if you haven't worked in London before, you haven't worked, you don't exist. And we were running out of money and it was going to shit pretty quickly. And I went out with a friend of a friend who was this really seasoned ad man. And he basically told me that I was going about the whole job hunting thing the wrong way. He gave me two pieces of advice. The first piece of advice, he said, go out and get a job, any job, tomorrow, now, like just get a job because it's easier to find work once you're in work. And then the second piece of advice, and the one that really stuck with me, was that he said that but people buy the solutions to the change they seek, and that we're all seeking change. We all want to be better. We all want to be more attractive or smarter or healthier or handier or fitter or whatever it is. We all want to be better. And so we seek the change. We seek the solutions to the change that will make us better. We seek brands and people that will do that. And what he pointed out to me is I'm approaching my job from my perspective, what I want. whereas putting myself in the other person's shoes and work out what they want. And so rather than what they want is difference. They don't want someone that's the same as everyone else. And as he pointed out, I was kind of suppressing my differences to fit in, to feel like I was part of the marketing groove, as opposed to accentuating my differences in order to stand out and be different. And so anyway, I took that, and the next day I got up. It was December 2002 in London, so middle of winter, and we'd been in London for 4 months. I got on the tube. I said to Emma that morning, my wife, I'm going to get a job today. I don't care what it takes. I'm going to get any job. And I got the tube to Hammersmith, got out at Hammersmith and walked down that long Kensington High Street strip towards Hyde Park, and knocked on every door I could. And to cut a long story short, I got to the end of the day. It was 4 p.m. I'd given out 50 CVs. I'd been knocked back from pubs and I was bloody after anything. The boot store didn't even want me. And I walked in, I saw this glowing little sign that said Trotters. It was a children's store that sold children's clothes, cut kids' hair and sold kids' shoes. So I've got zero fashion sense. I can't cut hair. And so it was shoes. So I've walked into this store and I've just got in my head, you know, people buy the solutions to the change they want. And this store was dead, right? And I'm thinking, oh, they need his sales. And so I've walked up and full of Aussie spirit to this woman that was at the back of this empty store, and gave her my pitch. And she said, have you ever fitted kids' shoes before? And I said, well, I'm a shoeologist. And she said, what's a shoeologist do? And I said, a shoeologist sells lots and lots of shoes. And so this woman, she was matronly, right? She was ice lady, and she smiled and she said, come back tomorrow and we'll see what you got. Anyway, that story, that as a, I don't know, is it a metaphor, that sense of being a shoeologist and being understanding what it is to walk in the shoes of those you seek to serve has kind of become my mantra in all my marketing years and now in business.
I like it. And then it was Nike, here we come.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That was a bizarre twist.
Well, my next question, it sort of is a bit superfluous now that you've told us that story, but it was to ask you about your passion for storytelling. Yeah. Which, that's a great example that you've just given us. But more interestingly, I guess, for us is the role of it in both life and in the corporate world. So where does storytelling fit for you?
Yeah, well, it strikes me that so much of life is about trying to influence others, whether it's in our personal life or our work life. Everything we do, whether it's trying to get the kids into the shower at night or managing someone or working with a client, we're trying to influence others. And the way I see it, there are basically two ways to do it. You can either sell or you can tell. And for me, when you sell something, it becomes very adversarial. It sets up a conflict. I want you to do something, and I have to convince you to do it. And so that automatically we're opposed. I'm on one side, you're on the other, and my job is to make you do it. Whereas when you tell something, when you tell a story, it's kind of like your Trojan horse. It's not adversarial at all. You're sharing your experience. You're starting with a problem, and you're taking people on a journey. I was listening to the Big Ideas podcast the other day, and they were talking about this concept of neurologists have proven that when someone challenges your idea, the neurological response is the same as being chased by a bear. So you go into this fight or flight mode, or freeze, I suppose. And that's exactly what it feels like when you're being sold to, as opposed to when someone is telling you a story, it's subtle. You're solving a problem and you're positioning yourself as the solution to that problem. And from a marketing point of view, you're positioning your product or service as a solution to that problem. So it feels much more of a real and connected experience, as opposed to an enforced and imposed experience.
Yeah, and as a consumer, when it sort of feels like it's your idea, you're more inclined to do it. But if you're just being sold to, it doesn't feel like your idea. It feels like a directive, and yeah, nobody likes that, I guess.
Totally. Well, it's about empathy, isn't it? So here's someone who understands me. Here's a brand or a person who understands what it is to be me and understands the problem I've got and can actually help me get better. But if you don't start at that point as in trying to influence someone, if you don't start with empathy, it's a very, very hard fight to convince someone that you want to do that, you want to, them to do something different.
Yeah. Yeah. Like for us, you know, we want to appeal to emotional connection that's going to make somebody want to come and see one of our shows.
Yeah.
That's how it applies, I suppose, in our world. So how did you arrive at this thinking? Was it the science of it, the neuroscience of it, or, you know, this gentleman that you met in London, or, you know, many things altogether, I guess?
Yeah, I think the idea of everybody seeking change and people wanting to be better is not new. The thought around starting with empathy forces you to think that way. We're starting to do more and more work with organisations who do pitches and presentations. And it's really interesting because you come in and it's, we usually come in at the 11th hour when they've done all the work and, or, you know, they have a regular pitch that they do. And you look at it and they're ticking boxes. They're ticking functional transactional boxes. We can do this, we can do this, we can do this, yada, yada, yada. We've got these contacts, we can do this. Whereas the opportunity lies, everyone can do that. Every competitor can do that. So what is it that makes you different, and what is it that's going to make you stand out? And we believe the thing that's going to make you stand out is when you position yourself as a solution to the other person's problem. So the person in the seat, the potential client that's making the decision, the customer, what's the emotional need that they have? What's going to make them better? Do they want to be more prestigious or premium or seen as more successful or influential? That's the thing that will get you the gig. Yes, you have to tick the other boxes and prove your functional worth, but it's your ability to elevate and float above the clouds and take them, transform them, help them on the journey to be better, to be what they want to be, that will get you the gig.
Yeah, well, that's fairly inspirational. When's our next pitch? What have we got to pitch for? I do love your approach to what brands really sell. And I guess this is this sell versus tell conversation. You always use that example when we chat. Colgate sells confidence, not toothpaste. You've got many of those sort of examples. Mm. So I guess we've sort of touched on it a bit, but tell us where you see kind of selling versus marketing come together there.
Well, I think it gets back to understanding what people want. People don't buy a product or service in isolation. They buy the change that they believe it can make in their lives. And so a clear brand story enables people to project outcomes. So if I buy brand X, I'm going to feel more Y. I'm a coffee lover and a self-admitted coffee snob. Do coffee snobs want a cup of coffee? No, they don't. Coffee snobs will walk past endless number of stores for however long it takes to find someone that understands what it is to roast the perfect bean, to have the right grind, to get the milk, the right silkiness, all of those things. So they'll pay whatever for it to get that perfect cup of coffee. So selling, I always say, selling assumes marketing positions. Selling says, here I am and here's what I've got. But marketing says, I know you, I understand you, and I'm here to help you get what you want to make you better.
Yeah, it's just that empathy again, isn't it?
Absolutely. If you genuinely think that way, you can't help but elevate your perspective from transactional to emotional. Yes, I know they want a cup of coffee, and there's plenty of people that'll buy a dollar cup of coffee from 7-Eleven, but that's not our market. That's not who we're going after, and people will pay $4.55 for a bloody cup of coffee that's not really that much, you know, better. But for them it is, because it's the experience, it's the emotion that's wrapped around it.
And just, I do love the one example story that you have around the female runners and the work you did with Nike. Do you want to tell us that story?
This is an amazing story. I started in Nike in 2005, and they had an ambition to be the number one running brand. And without going into too much detail, it was around technical running, so shoes that you put on your feet to actually run. And at the time, I remember the market share of Nike was 14%, 1-4 in technical running. Ahead of us was New Balance. Ahead of them was Brooks. And way, way, way out in the distance was Asics, of course, with 44%. And so we set a goal to be the number one running brand. And so after lots and lots of research and planning, we went into what was in retrospect three-year cycles. It wasn't planned this way. We hoped to be able to crack it in 3 years, and it took us 8. And in the second cycle, we started creating these experiences, and we started creating the Nike Run Club, and where people could turn up in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Auckland, and run their hearts out before work, after work. And what we were experiencing is that most of the people that were turning up were women, and they were turning up in groups. Girlfriends were turning up and running, which was kind of started to blow our minds, because the more women that came, the more men came, and these things just started to grow and grow. And so we started talking and working out what it was that these women wanted and what was stopping them being better. And there was lots of things, including product. But one of the really interesting things is that women shared with us that they couldn't run. One of the biggest fears that they had is they couldn't run when and where they wanted, and they were restricted by fear, and they were particularly restricted by running at night, which I'm sure is very real for a lot of people listening. And we knew that we could impact it in some small way, or at least had an obligation to impact it in some small way. So at the same time that this was happening, this is 2008 by now, innovation was going berserk. The Nike Free shoe had launched and was just going gangbusters. That whole barefoot running movement was going gangbusters commercially. And also the Apple-Nike relationship was just starting to boom. So the iPhone had been launched and things were going crazy. And so after lots and lots of conversations with women to better understand what they wanted, a story called She Runs the Night was born. And the whole story was around saying no, saying enough, standing up and giving the streets back to women so they could run when and where they wanted to. So we took that story, and that became our gospel for every decision we made. So we had midnight runs. We were running through parks late at night, running through the back streets of Sydney late at night, just doing shit that you weren't meant to do or was dangerous. And we made sure these women were safe. We made sure it was well lit. We put surprises. We put music. We put lights. We put cheer squads in these training runs. We had athletes. So that all culminated in a night in Sydney where in the wee hours of the morning, these women took over the streets. 5,000 women ran and partied on the finish line. And it was... an amazing moment, yeah. And it was not until 2013 that we eventually, Nike overtook Asics in technical running, which was, 8 years
took. There was a lot of ground to make up, though, 14% of 4% market share.
And Asics had done an incredible job through health professionals and podiatrists and physios, and really reinforcing that message of technical running shoes. So yeah, it was a really cool story. And you know, one night doesn't change a culture. Really conscious of that. But we did it 2 years in a row. But it was I still get goosebumps when I hear women talking about the experience they had on standing on the start line and then crossing the finishing line and seeing themselves on the massive screens and celebrating what it is to be a woman and run at night.
Yeah, that's awesome. Makes me want to go for a run at night. As soon as I step out there in the freezing cold of Melbourne, I'll be straight back in again.
Take your dog.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
With its dodgy hip.
Yeah, we can run together. So storytelling, like obviously what we've just, you know, the last 15 minutes of just chatting, we can see what a powerful way it is to get your message across by telling stories. And you do such a good job of that. So if we were to break it down, what are the key elements of a great story? What are the things that we should take away that we need to remember when we want to tell a great story?
I reckon there are three. The formula we use is truth plus story plus experience equals impact. I think it's important to remember that story is a means to an end. Telling a story is not the goal. It is simply a vehicle to get you to your goal. And the goal is to make an impact. We all want to make an impact. And our philosophy is that knowing what it is that you want to be known for and having a story is a vehicle and a very effective vehicle to help you make that impact. So story, truth, experience, just to quickly break down those three. Truth, story, experience. The truth that we're talking about here is twofold. The greatest impact you can make as a brand or as a person, and the greatest impact your audience seeks. Not transactional, emotional. The greatest impact you can make and the greatest impact your audience seeks. When you scale both of those up, you identify what we call your brand truth, where supply meets demand, or hopefully demand exceeds supply. And that part is important because every story is anchored in a truth. And when it's your business, it can't be, it needs to be an emotional truth, but it needs to be a commercial truth. You need to know if you're going to go out and tell this, you're going to earn bucks. So while you want to have an ambition beyond commercial success, which is where your truth will come from, at the end of the day, you need to make coin. So that's the first thing of identifying that brand truth. And then your story component, which is the second component, is framing that truth in the context of what your audience seeks. And you touched on it before. You don't buy toothpaste. Colgate don't sell toothpaste. Colgate sell confidence. Red Bull don't sell energy drinks. Red Bull gives you wings. That sense. So it's framing what you do in the context of what your audience wants. And you look at Nike or Airbnb or Apple, all those that have got ads on telly at the moment, that is exactly what they're doing. The hero of the story is not the brand, it's the consumer. There's a beautiful Airbnb ad, the campaign that they've got running at the moment, and they make the hosts the hero and then tag themselves. But you look at the ad and you can't help but go, oh, especially in COVID times, God, I want to get away. I want to run on that beach with the dog and play with the kids and you know, have a glass of red. That's what I want. They absolutely empathize with you and are solving my problem right there in the moment.
Yeah.
So truth, story, and then the third one is experience. And a brand story is not a logo or a words that sit behind the front desk. It must be immersed into the culture and you must live it. And the most effective way to tell a story is to give an experience. Mm. So that stories will make people listen, but it's not until you have an experience that you actually start to believe. And that's the aim. That's the ultimate aim. If you're anchoring in a truth, you tell a story, and then off that story, you create experiences that bring that story to life. And we've all had it. We've all had those moments in a restaurant or with a product or with working with a client, whatever, when you actually experience it and you go, man, I'm in. I don't care what it will take. I am in. I love this brand.
Yeah.
That's when it really comes to life.
And sorry to interrupt, but I just think the Nike example is such a good one there, because every woman who said, I want to run at night, I want to be able to, you know, go run whenever I want to, who fronted up that night, they did it. They had such an emotional connection to it. You can bet your bottom dollar the next pair of shoes they bought were Nike, because they thought subliminally, Nike enabled me to do this.
Yeah.
A great example of truth, story, and experience.
Yeah, and I think you hit on something really important there, that the brand is the enabler, not the hero. So the moment does not belong to the brand. You know your place. Help people be better. When you help people be better, by default, they attach very positive emotions to those that help them. In this case, a brand.
Yeah. Qantas does it so well too with their advertising that makes you just feel the most Australian you've ever felt in your life when you hear that song.
And
you
just totally. And coming home. And I think airlines are a really good example where there are airlines that sell bums on seats. And, you know, Jetstar, they'll sell a bum on a seat, which is all fine until someone else comes in with a cheaper price. Then what happens? What have you got? So you have commoditized your brand as opposed to attaching an experience and an emotion to a brand. And, yes, price will always play a role, but if you can layer in and establish an emotional attachment through story to that brand, you largely, well, to a certain degree, you take price out of the equation mm-hmm. because it's proven that people will pay for that experience to be able to say, I'm flying Qantas or I'm in the Qantas Club or whatever it might be. They'll pay for it.
Yeah. And that ad that they released during COVID where, you know, empty airports and empty, you know, multiple planes sitting on the tarmac or in the aircraft hangars. And as an Australian, you think, our Australian airline has been grounded. The next time I fly, I'm flying Qantas. Yeah, I want to support them. You know, it totally connects with you on an emotional level. So, I think they do it extremely, extremely well. Mm. Slight change of, I mean, your stories are so engaging and sort of slight sort of change of tact a little bit, but I've read a draft of your book and in that there is many, many, many stories that help us learn something about telling stories. But what's your secret to turning what feels like an everyday life event into a great story that's pretty impactful and one that we sort of want to share with other people? What's your secret?
I think there are three things. I mean, walking in the shoes of those you seek to serve is a common thread that we've already spoken about a lot. There's two others, and they are embracing vulnerability and telling the story the way the brain wants to hear it. So to talk about each of those, we've spoken about this a lot, but in embracing vulnerability, people don't care about your success. They care about your failure. So what stopped you getting it? What was the fight, the struggle that you had to go through to achieve what you wanted to achieve? And where did you finish up? What was your journey? What was your perspective? That's what people want to hear. And it's vulnerability that kind of unlocks the door and makes you human to all these things like curiosity and passion and laughter and love and humility and all those things where, you know, life's bloody hard sometimes and shit doesn't go right. And we all, you know, put on the happy face and we'll be right and we're great and our brand's amazing. Well, bullshit, it's a bloody tough struggle. So own it. And when that comes through, when you're able to share that in a genuine way, it kind of goes into the next point, which is tell the story the way the brain wants to hear it. Every story has a beginning, a middle, and an end, or as I call them, the problem, the fight, and the change. Every story starts with a problem. Meet a character, they want something, they can't get it. That's where the story starts. Every successful stage show, film, book, pick up a Roald Dahl. It's one of the best storytellers. It's all there. And so then the fight, that's when the story starts. So the character wants something, but they can't get it. So what do they do? What are the alternatives that they face? How do they try and get around it? And on that journey, they meet characters and stuff happens. We've spoken about this. I call it the square root of story. If you picture a square root,
the three phases. You go along at the start and meet the character. Boom, you drop off the cliff. Something happens and you go down and down and down while this character tries to find something. And then Wooshka, the square root ghost, starts to turn up as they do find a way through, as they meet someone that can help them, as they find out that life actually might be a bit different to the way they were going, and they elevate above where they started, and then they have a changed perspective and a changed view on the world at the end of it. So, yeah, tell the story the way the brain wants to hear it. Embrace vulnerability, because that's where the gold is. That's where all these nuggets are that you can bring it to life and understand what it is to walk in another's shoes.
And after you start intentionally thinking about the square root of stories, everybody, listeners, you will never watch a movie the same way ever again.
Yeah, I know. It kind of spoils it, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's set up, then something happens and you think, oh, how are they going to get out of this? What are they going to learn? And you as a consumer, you learn something as you move away from that book or that movie or, you know, that stage show in our world. So
yeah, totally.
So we've talked a lot about all these stories and how to tell them and, you know, and the impact that they have and they elicit change, particularly in a sales and marketing sense. What would be your all-time favorite brand story in your career so far?
I found this question really hard. It's kind of like asking which is my favorite child. My favorite brand story, it would be the story of Sids and Kids and their transition into Red Nose. And I'll tell you why. I think I mentioned this earlier, that a brand story is not just a marketing campaign or an ad or a slogan. It's a belief that permeates everything the company does, the way it acts. And a good brand story becomes a compass for the organization. So this story started the Sids and Kids. So for those who don't know, Sids and Kids is an amazing organisation that is now called Red Nose that started, and it's quite an emotional story, which is why it hits me so hard. It starts back in 1977 when Kareen and Kevin Fitzgerald were living in the burbs of Melbourne happily. Four children, eldest 5 and a half, youngest 8 months, and they found their 8-month-old child dead in his cot. And, And
it's tough. Take your time. I know this story.
Yeah. So Kareen was amazing. And Kevin credits Kareen for having the courage and the fight. And she declared there and then that no parent should have to live through what they lived through. And by the late 90s, they had reduced the number of children through research and education that die from sudden infant death syndrome by 86% in Australia alone. And that research was taken around the world and it has saved an incalculable number of lives. Yeah. So they're almost their challenges were because of their own success, because they've been able to be so successful. And so when our company, our agency entered the organization 4 or 5 years ago, what we saw was the shingle that they hung out the front, being Sids and Kids, no longer represented what they did internally. And what I mean by that is that they were now doing all this amazing work. They were taking the knowledge and IP and trust that they had that they used to so effectively reduce the number of sudden infant death syndrome cases, and they were applying it to stillbirth and miscarriage and what they call sudden and unexpected death in infants, which the numbers, but the sheer numbers are now in the thousands of children who die this way every year. And so they weren't saying what they do or doing what they say. And so now we had a situation where the most successful non-government funded public health campaign ever, Red Nose Day, wasn't doing what they said or saying what they did because they'd been so effective. And so through lots of research, and I'm certainly not saying that this is our work alone, it was very much a team effort, and it was a federated structure that became a national structure, incredible people all around Australia, most of whom are often bereaved parents themselves who have lost a child and go, I want to do something. And they now came together and they identified their truth as a future where no child will die suddenly or unexpectedly. And so I'm going to be quite clinical about this. What's the biggest impact that the audience wanted and what's the biggest impact they could make? Yeah. You ask any parent what their greatest fear is, and that is losing a child at any stage. Sorry.
It's really tough.
It is. It is. But it's really important because anchoring it in this truth, in the commercial truth, that's the challenge that needed to be solved. We had to, and people might listen to this and say, hey, you're being callous about the commercial thing. We're talking about lives. Yes, but it takes money to save lives.
Mm.
And some people would say to us, how can you have a future where no child dies suddenly and unexpectedly? And we would say, give me a number then. You tell me what number would be acceptable. And the answer is zero. And that's the fact. And it's amazing when you, so that was the truth. And then the story became Saving Little Lives, which is the incredible work that Red Nose do now. It's my favourite story because while it's awesome to talk about the swoosh or my time at Macca's or whatever, when you're doing something that's actually saving a child's life, and sometimes we don't even know it,
yeah.
It's incredibly rewarding.
The stakes just went up.
Oh, totally.
Mm. It's such a, I hate to kind of bring it back to stories, but you know, that is just so powerful. But the best takeout for me is it all started from a place of truth. So some of the buzzwords that you've been talking about, it starts from a place of truth. It's all about vulnerability. People lived the experience, you know, it's just all of the things that you've been talking about just captured in that one experience.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you know, passion is an incredible thing, mm-hmm. but passion must come after truth, because you can be as passionate as you like, but if you're not scratching an itch that needs to be scratched, then you can have all the passion in the world. It's like a musician who no one buys their songs. That's fine. Be a musician, go your hardest, play your guitar in your room, record what you like, but no one's buying your song, so just accept it. As opposed to, no, in this case, we need to generate money. We need to generate big mm-hmm. money in the millions every year to do the work we need to do to save the children's lives we need to save.
Yeah, and bridge that gap. Mm. Yeah, so we get to zero. Yeah, that's full on. I mean, and I, again, sorry to be clinical about it, but the not-for-profit world, I imagine, is where fit brand and partnerships can really make a huge difference, because I mean, this is a real generalisation, but I suspect they start with as a real passion project. They're real, but they come from a place of people just really feeling like there needs to be change. So the work that you and Bruce do, I think, can really steer a passion ship and put some tangible deliverables around it.
Yeah, it does. But interestingly, whether it's for-profit or not-for-profit, same rules apply. Mm. The difference often is we would always say to establish your truth and to have a really effective brand story, you need to have an ambition beyond commercial success. Mm. So even for a commercial organisation, even Nike, to bring innovation and inspiration to every athlete in the world, that's their goal. That's the truth that they recognise, and then they create stories that bring innovation and inspiration to every athlete in the world. You read Phil Knight's book, it ain't about making money. That guy was driven. That guy was driven to re-engineer the running industry. So it just becomes a little easier in some ways with a not-for-profit, because that's already there. And you go, right, great, the passion's there and the ambition beyond commercial success is there. Now we need to become more commercial about it.
Yeah,
and we need to position you as a leader. Whereas when you work with a commercial organisation, often it's about peeling back the onion and go, let's just park the dollars for a moment and let's work out the bigger picture. Because you know what? Consumers don't give a shit whether you make money or not. They care about you impacting their lives.
Yeah, that's just summed it up really, hasn't it? Because I was going to ask you about a bit more of the work that you're and the work that you're doing with brands through through Fit Brand and partnerships. So are there other examples that you can speak to on that?
Oh, there's lots. I think what we discover a lot is alignment is often the biggest challenge in these organizations. So getting all the parties together and being aligned in how they want to go forward, because often there's great ideas. So the way we work is to work together with the organization as opposed to putting a big report on the table and saying, you know, there it is, there's our findings, good luck with it. We have far more success when it's a very immersive process and we own the journey together, own the journey to find the truth. Who are you? What's the biggest impact you can make? What's the biggest impact the audience seeks? How can we frame that in the context of what consumers want? And then how can we bring that to life to make it real for the people internally and externally? And so that's where we have our most success, I suppose, working with brands, brand stories, and then sometimes finding story partners, finding other third-party organisations that can help that brand go out and tell their story to attract more audiences.
Yeah, brand association. And I know you and I talk about this a lot, but that concept of being a brand and being able to tell a story, this does translate to personal brands and to exactly, doesn't it? So where do you see the parallels in thinking between what you can do for a corporate brand and what you can do for a personal brand?
My experience is that the process is really the same. And while I'd never you know, think of someone as a brand, if you like, because we're way too nuanced and special to be thought of as brands. I know exactly what you mean, but the formula applies. So what's the truth, story, experience? Truth, what's the greatest impact you as an individual can make? And who's your audience, whether that be personal or professional, who's your audience and what's the greatest impact they seek? And so, you know, this is often about growth in professional life, in executive life with business leaders. You know, if you've been sitting in a CEO's chair for 18 months and you don't have growth, you got a target on your back. It's the unfortunate reality of life. You just do. And why do you want growth? Well, you want to keep your job, but you also want to feel great about it. You want influence. You want to go out to that opening night or whatever it might be and be the person that's just delivered growth for this organization. And so that's why we believe that it's critically important that as a leader, you know what you want to be, you know what you want to be known for, and you identify that truth and then shape your story around it. So you don't have to go out and tell your story every time someone says, what are you doing? And you launch into your whole story. It'll come out when it needs to come out. But having your audience know exactly what it is that you want to be known for, and then consciously creating experiences within what you do that deliver that, helps you grow, helps you make an impact, helps you have influence.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice for leaders, and it comes back to what you said at the start about elevating, that, you know, if it's real and true, and you can tell a story along those lines, then you're going to elevate because people are going to hear you when you talk, because there'll be an emotional connection. So,
yeah, it's that idea of elevation and perspective. It's so easily forgotten because we all of us commoditize ourselves. You know, this is what I do. Well, is that really the biggest impact you make? Is that really the best you can be? And then you dig and people go, oh, actually I've done this and I love doing this. And you go, right, now we're talking. That's the firecrackers are starting to go off, right? And that's what people buy. You know, that's your X factor. That's the thing that you do that others can't. And that's when you find that's when it becomes really special.
Yeah, but that might be the answer to the next question. If you could give one bit of advice to a business exec around their personal brand, in inverted commas, and of course the power of stories, what would that bit of advice be?
It would be have the courage to stand out. Yeah. There's lots of cultural signals that tell us to fall into line and to behave like everyone else. And the result is that we largely live in a homogenous wash of leaders and brands and categories that look like each other. If you think of the category you're in, or if you're listening to this, you think of a category you're in and your competitors, I'll bet that take away the colors and the logo, what's the difference? What's your competitive advantage? And so when someone enters, like I did, entering the corporate world, there's these silent signals that this is how you need to act. This is what you need to do. This is how you need to think. And some of them are actually really helpful, like putting on a suit and tie when you work at Macca's in the UK, because if you didn't do it, you'd get sacked. But some of them are just really not helpful, because if you start thinking like everyone else, you're not bringing anything to the table. You're not changing the perspective of those around you. So having the courage to know what your X factor is, know that thing inside you that is a little bit different to everyone else, and owning it and being quirky and being slightly weird about it and expressing it in a way that can change the perspective of others, is an incredibly powerful tool if you've got the courage to do it.
Yeah, I love it. I've also got images of you wearing a suit and tie flipping burgers.
It ain't pretty, I tell you.
No, that's been so good, Tim. We always like to finish with a few generic questions. And I know that you'll have a passionate response to this one, specifically, because we always like to start with this one. But why does arts matter to you?
I went to my 97-year-old auntie's funeral last week, and she had an amazing life, so it was a very happy celebration. But in her eulogy, her daughter said that when Auntie Peg used to talk about music, she loved music because it helped her remember the things she wanted to remember and forget the things she wanted to forget. And I thought to myself, oh, that is so true for me, with art and particularly music, but all types of art. But I think the thing for me that makes art matter so much is it actually helps us imagine the things that we weren't able to imagine. Great art takes your head to a place where you wouldn't have been able to go without it. A great painting, a great play, a great song, a great sculpture can for the artist and for the audience, can absolutely transform your thinking. Keating, use of Paul Keating references when he was strategizing. He used to put on his favourite classical music loud and just be like this nutty professor and think of things that no one had even thought of. And, you know, he was quite revolutionary, and you know, history will show him to be quite amazing in his thinking. But he talks about the role of art and the role that of art played in helping him do that. And I very much see that in other people, and occasionally see it in myself, that it's art that can help us picture a better world, help us picture the way the world might be able to be, and give us that little glimmer of hope that we can get there.
Yeah, it's a real escapism. Where did you discover, I mean, obviously you were in, this is probably a bit of a null and void question now that we know that you started as an actor, but where did you discover your love of live theatre and or entertainment?
I grew up in a theatrical family, not a theatrical treading the boards sort of family, but more of the Von Trapp or the Von Woods kind of family, I'm one of five, I'm the youngest of five, and there was a wonderful sense of theatre, again, not, you know, theatre as in stage theatre, but just a wonderful sense of the theatre of life. My father was a real estate agent and this superb auctioneer. And I used to love going and watching him on Saturday mornings ply his trade. It was like a theatre show. Oh, it was amazing. And all my brothers are auctioneers, and they're all amazing. But I had two brothers that played in a band, and so my Saturdays as a child would be spent in the garage watching these five teenage boys produce this amazing music. And so the singing around the piano, campfire songs, all these rituals and formalities that I think about in my childhood, the sort of, I suppose for me, the silent message was that the fun lived in the theatre of life. And which suited me perfectly. And I thought, I'm in the right family. And so, that's where my love for theatre came from, and my appreciation of what it is to sort of stand up and have a crack. I really incredible respect for people that are able to take risks and to give things a go and to fail and to get up and go again. It's I'm full of admiration.
Yeah, wow. You can, hearing that story, you can really see where your passion for stories is come from. It's been around you in some form or another all of your life.
My dad's an amazing storyteller in an old school story kind of way. He was a real estate agent, the local real estate agent in our country town, and we had two telephone lines, you know, one for the boys to be able to call their girlfriends on, and no one could touch the other line because it was Dad's business line. And I remember sitting in the hallway, and he would just talk for hours at night to clients, you know, wheat cockies and people that were selling their homes. And he would just, they'd be sitting there laughing and sharing stories and swapping yarns. And then he'd eventually get around to the sale and, you know, close the deal or do what he had to do. But it was this innate learning that I had of just listening to him connect through stories. And so I kind of grew up going, well, that's the way you do it. That's the way you connect. You share part of yourself. You be vulnerable. You have a laugh at yourself and you help others be better.
Oh, that's so true. And I think it just sums up perfectly our whole conversation today. So thank you so much. Could chat to you for hours about stories and hear your stories. You're such a passionate storyteller. But yeah, thanks, Jim. I think we all got a lot out of that today. So yeah.
Thank you, Lyndall. Awesome to chat as always. And thanks so much for listening.